This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. On March 14th, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame will hold its 26th annual induction ceremony. Among those to be honored are Neil Diamond, Leon Russell, Darlene Love, Dr. John, and two of our guests on today's show, Alice Cooper and Tom Waits. We'll hear from Tom Waits in the second half of the show. But let's start with one of the pioneers of what came to be known as shock rock. The name Alice Cooper thrilled teenagers and scared parents in the 1970s. In concert, his brand of theatricality was about breaking taboos and being decadent. He wore makeup, black lingerie, and a boa constrictor. He took a hatchet to female mannequins and spit into the audience. He often ended his performances in a guillotine. As intentionally crude as his stage show was, some of his songs were really catchy. A few of them became big hits, such as I'm 18, School's Out, and No More Mr. Nice Guy. Lots of bands have since copied Alice Cooper's looks and theatrics. Terry Gross spoke to Alice Cooper in 2007 and asked him how he transformed himself from Vincent Furnier into Alice Cooper. But first, let's hear what may be his most famous hit from 1972, School's Out.
Cooper, welcome to Fresh Air. Alice Cooper, I mean, the Alice Cooper act is, it's theater. I mean, it's not just a concert, it's theater. It's a whole persona, and, you know, there's, like, special effects, there's a snake. I mean, there's, you know, over the years you've done, you know, things with, crude things with mannequins. Alice gets executed at the end. Why did you want to do rock as theater, as opposed to just like doing straight concerts like most people were doing at that time?
That's exactly it, right? Just what you said. The idea of just doing a straight concert with no fun in it. You know, I mean, here, rock and roll, the most theatrical music in the world, and nobody was doing anything. I would look at bands that I really admired, like The Who and the Yardbirds, the Rolling Stones, and their theatrics were built into the character. They had, like, Pete Townsend was very theatrical. Mick Jagger was very theatrical. But I looked at the whole stage, and you have to remember, the original band were all art students. And we looked at that, and I said, why aren't they painting that canvas? You've got this entire stage up there, and nobody's doing anything with it. I also looked around, and I said, rock and roll is full of Peter Pans. Where's Captain Hook? And I will gladly be Captain Hook. I always thought the villain always got the best lines. The villain was always the one that everybody kind of really wanted to see. And so I created this Alice Cooper character to be all of those villains wrapped up into one, you know, with a certain amount of tongue-in-cheek. I definitely, you can't do horror without having a punchline. I think you need to make the audience laugh. If you scare them, you need to make them laugh at the same time.
There's been so many stories over the years about how you created the Alice Cooper persona. I'd love to hear you tell the story.
We were a good rock band. We lived with the Pink Floyd, and, you know, we were, playing gigs with the Doors and the Mothers of Invention and all that. Nobody would record us. Finally, Frank Zappa did record us and, you know, put us on Warner Brothers. But there was that moment of saying, we're frustrated. We better do something that's going to get a lot of attention. That's when Alice was created. That's when I said, let's create this character that every parent in the world is going to hate. You know, Alice Cooper, it's a guy. It's a band of guys. We're wearing makeup. We're wearing our girlfriend's lingerie, only we've got black leather pants on and cod pieces and we have canes. We're more of Clockwork Orange than Clockwork Orange. We were as dangerous, and we didn't mind a little bit of violence up there. We borrowed a little bit of West Side Story. This was 1970 when people were easily shocked. I always said that we were the band that drove the stake through the heart of the Love Generation. You know, we were the next thing. But the thing about it was I looked at whatever happened to Baby Jane, you know, Betty Davis. And I looked at that old lady with that caked makeup on and sort of those black smeared on eyeliner.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, that's truly frightening. That to me is scary. And then we saw Barbarella and we saw Anita Pallenberg played the Black Queen. And I said, that's what Alice should look like right there. And, you know, and all the guys were all straight. You know, nobody was gay. But we had no problem, you know, wearing a piece of women's clothing.
Dressing in things like what? Like leather corsets and wearing makeup?
Well, yeah, sure. I wouldn't have any problem with that. As long as, you know, I mean, I was very secure with my manhood. Girls loved it. The girls, oh, yeah, are you kidding? Because everybody was, you know, Neil Young and Stephen Stills, and everybody was this, you know, hippie kind of look. And all of a sudden, here was this band of guys that were kind of like androgynous. And this was pre-Bowie. And you're wearing a great big boa, you know.
Right.
And you're wearing black leather, tight black leather jeans and boots and a switchblade and your girlfriend's slip top that's all cut up with blood all over it. And black leather gloves. And this is 1968, 69.
Mm-hmm.
People are going, oh no, my son's not going to, that's not going to be my. And so that when they walked into their room and that poster was in their son's room, why do you think that poster was in there? Because mom and dad hated it so much.
If you're just joining us, we're listening to an interview Terry Gross recorded with Alice Cooper in 2007. He'll be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame later this month. Terry asked him how the band came up with its name.
We're sitting around and we're talking about what could we name ourselves. Now, the obvious thing is, you know, some horrific name, you know, Venom or something like that, you know, Husky Baby Sandwich or something, you know. and we're sitting there and I went, Alice Cooper. And that was the first name that came out. I said, what if it was like a little old lady's name, a little old librarian, you know, but this little old librarian is like a serial killer, you know, nobody ever suspects her. It sounds like a little girl, Alice Cooper, a little sweet little girl, and they get us. And we all kind of like that idea, the fact that nobody would see us coming. And what we were, I mean, we were actually pre-Clockwork Orange. And Clockwork Orange borrowed an awful lot of Alice Cooper. The cod pieces, the canes, the snakes, the makeup. The guy's name was Alex, not Alice.
Uh-huh.
There was a ton of Alice Cooper in Clockwork Orange.
You mentioned in your memoir that as a kid, you know, you were an athlete, you wrote for the high school paper, you were pretty popular, you were cool, but you couldn't fight. So when you're on stage and you were being like the scary villain character, the horror character, was there any kind of compensatory aspect to it because you couldn't fight as a kid, but here you were being this like scary guy?
Well, you know, the funny thing was it wasn't that I couldn't fight. It was the fact that, in fact, I was from Detroit, where you better. I had a lot of fights when I was a little kid in Detroit. And then when we moved back to Detroit, again, back to the toughest neighborhoods in the world, it wasn't that I couldn't fight, it just that I was the great diplomat. I was the dark side of Ferris Bueller. I could talk my way out of a sunburn, you know. And I was always good at talking my way out of it. You know, I always said, why would you want to beat up me? I weigh 100 pounds. You know, the guy was going to beat me up, and I'd go, I'll tell you what, name me a girl in this school, and I'll get you a date with her.
Could you do that? Could you deliver?
Oh, absolutely. The girls loved us.
How would you do it?
You know,
how would you get the
date? I was just a charmer. I was an absolute charmer. I'd go to the girl and I'd go, hey, look, you know, you're the best looking girl in school. I mean, everybody knows that. And this guy over here is going to kill me if you don't do this. You know, could you just do me a favor and go out with this guy? And honestly, I'll owe you a big favor after this. And you have to remember now, in high school, we were the biggest band in Phoenix. We played at the best club in Phoenix, and we had a record on the charts when we were in high school. We owned that school. We owned everything about it. And on top of it, we were athletes. We were four-year lettermen. We had the jocks covered. We had the, you know, we had the everybody out there. And honestly, nobody could beat me up because I was in the Letterman's Club. They'd get killed by the football team. You couldn't beat up a letterman, you know. So, I mean, honestly, we had that school so wired. It was unbelievable.
I find it so kind of amusing that you're so, like, easy to talk to and you are such a charmer, and how different that is from the Alice Cooper stage image.
Well, the Alice character has never, ever talked to the audience. I mean, when I created this character, I said, well, what would he do? What wouldn't he do? You know, you have to remember now, Alice is my favorite rock star. I create Alice to be what would I want to see this character do. And I talk about Alice in the third person because when I play Alice, I play him in the third person. And so would Alice say thank you? No. Alice wouldn't get up there and go, gee, I hope you like us tonight. Here's a song we wrote in 1968. And Alice gets up there and grabs him by the throat and says, come here, you're mine. It's almost he's almost the dominatrix.
Right.
You know, and the audience is a trick as far as he's concerned. There's a certain amount of real anticipation behind it. You see that blade.
Mm-hmm.
It's a 40-pound blade. It's razor sharp, and it really only misses me by about 6 inches.
It's a real guillotine.
Oh, yeah, and it's a good trick. But if I didn't do the trick right, it would cut my head off. I mean, don't try this at home, by the way. I'm a professional.
Can you describe
the trick?
In case
any of you people have guillotines at home.
Away?
Well, it's a trick. It's an old vaudeville trick. In fact, you know, when guys like Groucho Marx would come to the show, Groucho saw us as the last. He always called me, he says, you're the last hope for vaudeville. And he would bring Jack Benny and George Burns and Mae West, and people like that would come to the show because it was vaudeville to them. They said, ah, I remember 1923, the great Floyd used to do that. You know, of course, he would have doves come out of his sleeves. And this was nothing new to these guys. They would, you know, Groucho would come to the show and he'd see it and he'd go, you know, he'd insult everybody there. Excuse me, I've got to go insult the Major D, you know, that kind of thing. And we were best of friends, Groucho and I were. But they saw it as vaudeville, and actually that's what it is. It's rock and roll vaudeville. But this generation, the last five generations, have no idea what vaudeville is. So to them, it's something new. It's some kind of strange, dark cabaret.
So can you describe the guillotine trick, like how it's done?
Well, the guillotine, you are in the guillotine in a stock, right? And you are holding yourself up with the hands. The audience sees your head in the stock. And there's a basket in front of you. What they don't see is that when the guillotine comes down, it's one point you let yourself go and your whole body drops, okay? They don't see that. They only see your head lop off. They see your, because they only see your head fall down, and then there's a fake back that comes up and gives it the illusion that your head literally comes off. Now, we learned the trick. The great Randy was one of the guys that helped us with it, and it looks perfect. And then, of course, the guy, the executioner, pulls the head out, and the head is rigged so that he looks at the head, he talks to it, and he turns around, and the head spews blood out of its mouth into the audience, like it throws up what's left of it. It's not dead yet, you know. Now, it's so over the top that if you're not laughing by now, there's something wrong with you.
But the thing is, though, that some of your fans took it really seriously, It leads to the chicken story.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, the chicken story was one of those things that nobody saw that one coming. We're playing in Toronto, and my manager, Shep Gordon, who I've been with 38 years, who's also total vaudeville, totally gets it, you know. He's the one guy that always goes, let's go for the Hollywood publicity stunt, you know. We're going to go on between John Lennon and the Doors. Now you have to remember, nobody's ever heard of us, but he promoted the concert and 60,000 people there. And we didn't get paid. Our payment was that we went on at the end between the two biggest acts. So in the end of our show, we always used to do a thing where we would open up a feather pillow and CO2 cartridges, and the whole stage was a flurry of feathers. In the middle of all this, all of a sudden, I look down and there's a chicken. Somebody threw a chicken on stage. Now, it never occurred to me, here's a guy, I see I got my keys, I got my tickets, I got my drugs, I got my chicken. Who would bring a chicken to a rock concert? It wasn't us. We didn't bring it. I mean, I never thought of using a chicken on stage. So there's this white chicken. And being from Detroit, never being on a farm in my life, it had feathers, it had wings, it was a bird. It should be able to fly. Is that not logical?
Oh, I understand.
I understand. And I pick it up and I kind of like softly, you know, throw it into the audience where it didn't fly as much as it plummeted into the audience, and the audience tore it to pieces.
Yeah.
Next day in the paper, Alice Cooper rips chicken apart and drinks the blood, and I was the new geek of all time. Of course, nobody had a picture of it because it didn't happen. Now, I got a call the next day from Frank Zappa, who was producing me at the time, and he goes, Alice, did you kill a chicken on stage last night? And I went, no. He says, well, don't tell anybody. They love it. He says, everybody's talking about it.
I guess there's a part of me that wonders if, in a way, Alice wasn't the villain here in the sense that maybe the fans were kind of behaving the way they thought you wanted them to behave or the way they were expected to behave at an Alice Cooper concert. You know, a chicken, yeah, we're villains too. Let's get the chicken.
That could be it. And it also could be the fact that they were the ones that were high. We weren't. We were in the band. We didn't get high. We drank a little beer. That was about it.
Can I just name a few names for you and get your really short take on them?
Sure.
Great. Kiss.
Kiss. We told Kiss where to buy their makeup. Everybody wanted there to be a huge feud between Kiss and us because they were the great copycats. Alice came out with the makeup. Kiss came out with the makeup. Their very first statement was, if one Alice works, then four ought to work. Now, my joke with them, and they're friends of mine, was they use pyro. I never used pyro. I said, as long as you guys don't do my show and do different records, there's room for us both out here. Just don't be Alice Cooper. So they turned into four comic book characters. Mm-hmm. They were like the X-Men, mm-hmm. whereas Alice Cooper was Phantom of the Opera, you know? I always used to laugh, and I say, when you guys can't think of anything clever to do, you just blow something up.
Okay, Marilyn Manson.
Marilyn Manson, you know, understood what Alice was, looked at it and said, I'm just going to up the ante. I'm going to be Marilyn Manson. Okay, Alice Cooper, Marilyn Manson. Okay, let me see a girl's name. Gee, I wish I would have thought of that. Makeup. Oh, wait a minute. I did that. But he said, okay, my thing is, now Alice did makeup, snakes, and violence, mock violence on stage. Okay, what am I going to do? Okay, I'm going to be a devil worshiper, drug addict, da-da-da. That'll get him. What he does is very stylistic.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's missing the sense of humor in it, and I certainly object to a lot of the things when it comes to tearing pages out of the Bible. And he became an anti-Alice as soon as he heard I was Christian.
Really?
He just publicly said, I hate Alice now. Why? Because he's Christian.
And I want to ask you about Frank Sinatra, and here's why. In a concert film from 1973, you come out first in a white tuxedo singing The Lady is a Tramp, a song
she
Sinatra made famous.
She gets too hungry for dinner at 8.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he was the first punk.
Wait. Then you say in the middle of a song, you go, I have had enough of this, and you act like really angry, and you strip out of the out of the tuxedo and start getting into Alice Cooper drag. But I figured you must love Sinatra.
Loved Sinatra. He actually was a friend. And Frank Sinatra totally got Alice Cooper. In fact, all of the Hollywood guys, the old pros, got Alice Cooper. They got it. They understood what it was. They saw the image. They said, oh, I get it. Okay, cool. He's playing this thing to the hilt. Way to go. And the hit records keep coming. Frank Sinatra did one of my songs. He did You and Me at the Hollywood Bowl one night. I actually got along quite well with Frank Sinatra. he looked at me as an original, and of course, everybody, you can't beat Sinatra. He's the best voice of all time.
Well, Alice Cooper, it's really been fun talking with you.
Well, thank you very much. We had done some fun stuff.
Alice Cooper speaking to Terry Gross in 2007. On March 14th, he'll be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We'll hear from another inductee, Tom Waits, in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Another of the inductees in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year, along with Alice Cooper, is singer-songwriter Tom Waits. Critic Daniel Dirkholz described his voice as sounding, and I quote, like it was soaked in a vat of bourbon, left hanging in the smokehouse for a few months, and then taken outside and run over with a car. Here is that voice, singing Misery is the River of the World.
All that the monkey can climb, no more he shows his tail. Call no man happy till he dies, there's no milk at the bottom of the pail. God built a church, the devil built a chapel, like the thistles that are growing on the trunk of a tree. All the good in the world you can put inside a thimble, and still have room for you and me. If there's one thing you can say about mankind, there's nothing kind about man. You can drive out nature with a pitchfork, but it always comes roaring back again. Misery's the river of the world. Misery's the river of the world. Misery's the river of the world.
Tom Waits is one of the true eccentrics of pop music. The people he sings about are usually outlaws, drunks, hobos, and losers. The darkness of his lyrics is accentuated by the rumble and rasp of his voice, a voice that sounded old even when he was young. Waits has been recording since 1973. His songs have been used on the soundtracks of several films, and he's acted in the movies Down by Law, Shortcuts, Wolfen, Bram Stoker's Dracula, and Coffee and Cigarettes. Terry spoke with Tom Waits in 2002.
Some of your music writing seems influenced by the German songs of Kurt Weill. Have you listened a lot to him? Do you feel like he's influenced your writing?
Well, you know, I hadn't really listened to him until I had people tell me that I sounded somewhat like him or had some influence in there. So I said, well, I better start listening to this stuff. And
what'd you think?
I liked it. It's really, a lot of it's really angry. And I guess I like beautiful melodies telling me terrible things.
And, small put, yeah.
So it works for me. Yeah.
What was the music that you grew up listening to because your parents were listening to it? I mean, before you were old enough to choose music yourself, what was the music in your house?
Really young mariachi music, I guess. My dad only played a Mexican radio station, and then Frank Sinatra, and later Harry Belafonte, and then I would go over to my friends' houses, and I would go into the den with their dads and find out what they were listening to. That's what I was really. I couldn't wait to be an old man. I was about 13, you know. I didn't really identify with the music of my own generation, but I was very curious about the music of others. And I think I responded to the song forms themselves, you know, cakewalks and waltzes and mm-hmm. barcaroles and parlor songs and all that stuff. I think which are just really nothing more than jello molds for music. But I seem to like the old stuff, Cole Porter and Oscars and Hammerstein and Gershwin and all that stuff. I like the melody.
So when you were 13, being more interested in the music of your parents, your friends' parents, than in your friends' music, what was the music of your generation that didn't interest you?
You know, like the Strawberry Alarm Clock, or I didn't really.
Right.
But later, I like that stuff. You know, like The Animals and Blue Cheer and you know, Led Zeppelin and all that stuff. And The Yardbirds and, you know, of course, Rolling Stones and the Beatles and Bob Dylan. And, James Brown, I was really, really hot on James Brown.
Now, you said your father listened mostly to the Mexican station and to mariachi music.
Yeah.
Was your father Mexican?
No, my dad's from Texas. He grew up in a place called Sulphur Springs, Texas. And my mom's from Oregon. She listened to church music, you know, all that, Brother Springer, all this. She used to send money into all the preachers, you know. And but the early songs I remember was Abilene. When I heard Abilene on the radio, it really moved me. And then I heard, you know, Abilene, prettiest town I've ever seen. Women there don't treat you mean. And Abilene, I just thought that was the greatest lyric. You know, women there don't treat you mean. And then, you know, Detroit City. Last night I went to sleep in Detroit City. And I dreamed about the cotton fields back home. I liked songs with the names of towns in them, and mm-hmm. I think I liked songs with weather in them, and something to eat. So I feel like there's a certain anatomical aspect to a song that I respond to. I think, oh, yeah, I can go into that world. There's something to eat. There's the name of a street. There's a, okay, yeah, there's a saloon, okay. So I think probably that's why I put things like that in my songs.
I want to play another track from Blood Money, and this is called A Good Man Is Hard to Find. This is Tom Waits.
Well, I always play Russian roulette in my head. 17 black. 429 red. How far from the gutter, how far from the pew. I will always remember to forget about you. Good man is hard to find. And my favorite words are goodbye. And my favorite color is red.
Now I want to ask you about your voice. You have a very raspy singing voice. Was that a sound that you strove for, you know, that you worked on having, or is it what naturally developed?
It's that old man thing. I couldn't wait to be an old man. Old man with a deep voice. I scream into a pillow.
Well, you know, John Mahoney, the actor?
Sure, yeah.
He told me he actually did stuff like that, wanted a distinctive voice. And, and so he used to do these exercises that he practiced in a closet of just, like, shouting and trying to, you know, like, growl a lot. And
yeah.
He actually permanently did something to his vocal cords as a result of it.
Yeah, hooray. I'm all for it.
was, say, Louis Armstrong an influence on you?
Oh, God, yeah, sure. Yeah. You know, you can't ignore it. The influence of someone like Louis Armstrong. It's, you know, he's like a river. He's like a country to be explored in and of himself. And but yeah, he was like he came out of the ground just like a potato. You know, he's completely natural. Yeah, sure, love those tunes. And but this one, this Good Man's Hard to Find was, yeah, it was an attempt to kind of tip my hat somewhat to that.
Right.
Yeah.
Have you ever worried about hurting your voice by...
Oh, I've heard it. Yeah, I have heard it. But I have a voice doctor in New York who used to treat Frank Sinatra and various people. He said, "Oh, you're doing fine. Don't worry about it."
That's good. Now, you once said that you wish you could have been a part of the Brill Building era in which people like Carole King and Lee Bernstoller and Ellie Greenwich and Jeff Barry were writing songs for singers and for vocal groups. What do you think you would have liked about that?
Oh, I guess writing at gunpoint sounds really exciting to me. Those kinds of deadlines. I went to a rehearsal building on Times Square in New York one afternoon, and a really tiny little room. In fact, it was probably smaller than the room I'm in right now, which is a little larger than a phone booth. There's just enough room for a little spinet piano, and then you could just barely close the door, and there you were. And it was, and you could hear every kind of music coming to you through the walls and through the windows and underneath the door. And you heard African bands, and you heard, like, comedians, and you'd hear applause every now and then, and you'd hear tap dancers, and I think I just liked the whole melange of it, the way it all kind of mixes together. Mm-hmm. I like turning on two radios at the same time and listening to them. I like hearing things incorrectly. I think that's how I get a lot of ideas, is by mishearing something.
What was your first instrument?
I don't know. I don't know. Probably a box. Something.
But I mean, the first instrument.
Oh, my dad gave me a guitar when I was about 9, and I learned El Paso, and actually, I learned it in Spanish because he wouldn't purchase any like English speaking records. He didn't like them. And in fact, I remember going by.
This is your father, yeah.
It's my dad, yeah. We went by a stop sign once. There was a guy in a hot rod with with a duck tail and everything, greased down here, comb way back. And he's gunning the motor, and we're in the station wagon. And he looked over at that guy, and then he looked over at me, and then, as if to say, "Don't get any ideas," But so I had a guitar. I learned 3 chords. I thought I knew everything, and it kind of grew from there.
Now, you dropped out of high school. Why did you drop out? Is there something that you want to do instead, or did you just hate going?
Oh, I wanted to go into the world. Mm-hmm. Enough of this. Mm-hmm. I didn't like the ceiling in the rooms. I didn't like the holes in the ceiling, the little tiny holes in the corkboard and the long stick used for opening the windows.
Oh, God. Yeah, we had one of those in my elementary school.
I just hated all that stuff. I was real sensitive to my visual surroundings, and I just wanted to get out of there.
Did you ever do the street musician thing?
I didn't, but when I see people do it, I see, oh, man, I should have done that. That's how you really get your chops together. But my first gigs, my first big gigs, are opening the show for Frank Zappa, and I think that was difficult. I was kind of like the rectal thermometer for the audience, and it was a little awkward for me. I was alone, and I was performing in front of large groups of people, and they were verbally abusive, and I think I'm like a dog. I was beat as a dog, so...
Is there a point in your career that you see as a turning point from getting to where you are now from where you were when you started performing?
Oh, yeah, probably. Well, I got married, really. That was it. I mean, that's like the most important thing I ever did. And then Kathleen really was the one who encouraged me to produce my own records,
Mm-hmm. What kind of music background is she from?
She's got like opera in there, and she was going to be a nun, So we changed all that.
Yeah, I guess so. Tom Waits, thank you so much. It's really been great to talk with you. Thank you.
Oh, we're all done.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Nice to talk to you, Terry.
Tom Waits speaking to Terry Gross in 2002. The 26th Annual Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony will be held March 14th. Next week, we'll feature interviews with other artists to be honored at that same ceremony: Darlene Love, Neil Diamond, and Dr. John. This is Fresh Air. I'm TV critic David Bianculli. On broadcast television, the February ratings sweeps ended Wednesday. Sweeps periods are when the networks compete aggressively to attract the largest audiences, because those are the numbers used to set advertising rates for the next 3 months. That's why, now that the February sweeps are over, almost all network shows are reruns. And it's also why we're about to face a new onslaught of reality TV shows. Reality shows are a low-cost, low-risk way of rolling the dice and hoping for a sudden hit. If it doesn't catch on, no big deal. You finish out the cycle and replace it with something else, or scrap it immediately if the ratings are that low. But if it hits big, it's a major moneymaker. Yet a decade into the current cycle of broadcast TV reality shows, much of the novelty has worn off. Even the durable programs have to rely on tricks to keep audiences coming back. Donald Trump's The Apprentice series on NBC has upped the ante with celebrity editions for a while now, even though its definition of celebrity is way too generous. This Sunday, the newest cycle of Celebrity Apprentice premieres, and the loosest cannon in its arsenal is Gary Busey, whose level of quirkiness has fueled other reality shows in the past. So here he is, misbehaving again, with predictable unpredictability. And that's the problem with reality TV this year. Even when the programs aren't familiar reruns, the contestants are. On CBS, we have former Survivor contestants Russell and Boston Rob fighting it out on new teams. On the same network's The Amazing Race, we have 16 losing teams from former editions lining up to try again. Another problem is that even a new show can seem old because its parts are so familiar. ABC this weekend launches Secret Millionaire, which is an unwatchable ripoff of the nearly as manipulative Undercover Boss on CBS. Is there any broadcast TV reality show with a spark of originality these days? Yes, there is. And, like Secret Millionaire and Celebrity Apprentice and The Amazing Race, it shows up this Sunday. It's NBC's America's Next Great Restaurant, and it comes from the producers of Bravo's Top Chef. There are two variations that make this new show stand out. One is that instead of having cooks compete for prizes or a dream job in a top restaurant, as they do on Top Chef and Gordon Ramsay's Hell's Kitchen, this time they compete for investors and the chance to launch a dream business. That's a familiar idea, too, from such shows as ABC's Shark Tank. But in America's Next Great Restaurant, all the contestants are competing in the same category for the backing to open a chain of 3 restaurants. They're trying to impress the likes of chefs Bobby Flay and Curtis Stone, and this time the panel isn't just judging, it's mentoring. Here's the way the narrator describes it in Sunday's premiere.
Each week, the contestants will work side by side with the investors to further develop their concepts. They'll hire chefs, design a uniform, operate their own food trucks, and build their restaurants. And each week, someone will go home.
I'm sorry, we will not be investing in your restaurant.
I know that I'm a good chef.
I'm going to miss her so much.
The stakes couldn't be any higher.
The stakes, in that context, don't refer to juicy grilled pieces of meat. But those come later, along with casual restaurants built around grilled cheese sandwiches, Indian fusion, and meatballs. In episode 1, the judges hear the pitches, taste the food, and select the finalists. In week 2, the contestants are taken to an open-air mall to set up booths and serve one sample item to a crowd of 1,000 people, each of whom has a vote. And the judges are checking them out, too, passing judgment on everything from the food to the logo and even the name. Here are Bobby Flay and Curtis Stone sampling the wares of one contestant who's serving up small bowls of meatballs. He's nervous as the judges taste a sample, happy as they ask for more, then nervous again as they turn around and start questioning some of the customers, asking them specifically about the name he's chosen for his would-be restaurant.
What have we got here?
Hey, what's happening?
We got saucy balls, sir. How are you?
The amount of sauce compared with a meatball, they really are saucy balls. It's good, sir.
Thank you.
Talk to us about the name and the logo.
Putting grandma up there, to me it shows that you're going to have a nice home-cooked meal here.
Do you think that the name, Saucy Balls, do you think there's anyone that might find it a little bit
Bad Taste. I think we'll attract a lot more people than we'll offend with that name.
You want another one? You all right?
Yeah.
Woo!
Yeah!
The food is delicious. Doesn't offend anybody?
Nobody's offended by it?
No, it's not offensive.
Like, if you're with your friend, but you wouldn't be like, hey, Grandma, let's go eat at Saucy Balls, you know?
I suspect that with this show, as with American Idol, a finalist need not win to succeed. After a few weeks of exposure on a show like this, they might find other investors eager to help them make their dreams come true. But for that to happen, America's Next Great Restaurant has to last a few weeks. And most new TV shows, like most new restaurants, fail quickly. But America's Next Great Restaurant, with a tone that is more positive than negative, is one show I expect will beat the odds. The judges are sincere and likable. The show taps into a common dream. It makes me smile, and at times, it even makes me hungry. The story of the kidnapping and subsequent death in 1996 of seven French monks in Algeria is the basis for the new French film of Gods and Men. The monks were kidnapped by an armed Islamic terrorist group, but it remains unclear who actually murdered them. The film won the grand prize at last year's Cannes Film Festival. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Of Gods and Men is the English title of Xavier Beauvoir's stark drama, Des Hommes et des Dieux, which is, of course, of men and gods. It's a small reversal, but it bothers me. The film is foremost about men, French Trappist monks in the mid-1990s doing good works in a poor Algerian hill town. It centers on whether they should stay in their monastery while Islamic terrorists are roaming the countryside, killing foreigners and non-fundamentalists. In answer to the monks' prayers for guidance, there is no sign from on high, and no moment in the film you might call transcendental, heavenly light or soaring music, or anything that suggests divine intervention. It's all rather plain and down to earth. Faith, the film implies, is hard won, and the battle to discern God's will never ends. What is that will? The Islamic extremist God is intolerant and cruel, the monks compassionate and non-judgmental. The focus throughout is on the human perception of the Almighty, so of men and gods. Whatever the film's title, the monks' intransigence is controversial, even early on within the fold. They're seen praying and chanting, toiling in the fields, teaching and giving medical aid, and affectionately interacting with the locals, all while debating whether they should indeed get out. The country's military officials strongly urge them to flee, and some of the brothers feel their exit is inevitable. But the abbot, Brother Christian, played by Lambert Wilson, quietly refuses to let go of his mission. He does not even accept the military's offer of armed guards at night. He says he'll lock the door. It's a mark of the movie's power that you rarely feel like slapping Brother Christian and dragging him to a departing plane. It's also a mark of its even, lucid spirit that this view of Christian missionaries bringing Western civilization to the Arab world doesn't play like old-fashioned colonialist propaganda. Director Beauvoir shows over and over how the brothers accept the locals' faith. Brother Christian studies the Koran and even says goodbye to a village friend with Insha'Allah, meaning God be with you. He attends the Muslim equivalent of a christening and doesn't flinch at prayers asking Allah for help against the people of the unbelievers. The great old French actor Michel Lonsdale plays the gentlest monk, the physician who also counsels a young village woman on love. They are men who see themselves as representatives of their loving God. Of Gods and Men has a somewhat monotonous structure. Basically, we're waiting for the bad guys to show up. But the brothers' debates pull you in. One says he didn't become a monk to have his throat slit. Another asks whether martyrdom will truly serve a higher purpose. Brother Christian is adamant that, quote, the good shepherd doesn't abandon his flock for the wolves. After the final decision is made, Beauvoir delivers a tour de force sequence in which his camera holds on each man alone with his own thoughts. And even though they're listening to the now over-familiar overture from Swan Lake, it's so moving you can nudge out of your mind the vision of Natalie Portman swooning in a flutter of bloody feathers. Even ye of little faith will be envious when the brother played by Michelle Lonsdale says, "I'm not scared of death. I'm a free man."
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Lambert Wilson, one of the stars of the film of Gods and Men, is well known in France for his many roles in movies, TV shows, and musicals. Here he is singing on his collection of French songs recorded in 2007.
Trois c'est trop pour le tango. Et dessus quelquefois trop.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.